As you know from my prior life, I was an engineer. I was an engineer for 10 years. I was an engineer in the Navy, by the way, for 10 years, and I went to School of Mines. And as an engineer, we base our findings on real experiments, real observations, real studies. How many of you like engineers to do that? Yeah, I do too. And then I got out and went to medical school. And as a medical doctor, we treat patients and we give them medications based on studies that are based on real experiments and real observations. And I suppose you're glad that your doctor does that as well. There, it's not a fictitious thing. So, why don't we approach geology? Could catastrophe, in other words, a worldwide global flood as described in the Bible, be the best explanation for the things that we see in the world around us? I'm going to argue that it is, and it's going to be based on some real studies. First one is a really fascinating finding, some soft tissue in solid rock. It began with this scientific paper published in 2005 by a paleontologist from the University of North Carolina, where she seemed to find soft tissue in a Tyrannosaurus bone, Rex bone, that supposedly had been fossilized for 65 million years. And she was following up on some previous research in the 1990s as well. And it was a femur bone. That's the long bone in the upper part of your thigh. And supposedly the bone had been dead, as I said, and buried for 65 million years. And this is what she found. She found a blood vessel with a red blood cell in it. Not a fossilized vessel and a fossilized cell, a real blood vessel with a real blood cell. And you see the blood cell right there, right inside that femur bone. Now that's kind of interesting. In addition to that, she found tissue like collagen tissue, like you have on your knees and other joints in that bone, fresh looking bone, and pieces of bone that were connected by connective tissue, that if you took those two pieces of bone and you pulled them apart, they would snap back. It was still stretchy tissue. Stretchy tissue. Now, all of you are wondering, how can that be? Because some of your tissue doesn't snap back anymore. You know, when I was 5 years old, I was sitting next to my grandma, I would pinch the skin up on the back of my hand, and it would immediately go, boom, snap right back. But I could pinch my grandma's up, and it would stay straight up. It wouldn't snap back. And I asked her, Grandma, how can you get your skin to do that? And she said, well, that's a trick that only grandmas know how to do on there. Well, that's because it's breaking down. It's not just grandmas. I'm now checking my skin daily, and it's beginning to tint more and more on that. Well, that's a pretty remarkable finding for something that's 65 million years old. Now, I want you, as evolutionists do, they want you to imagine how long 65 million years is in order to evolve a Tyrannosaurus rex. Now, I want you to imagine how long 65 million years is to keep this tissue like this. Maybe that's not quite 65 million years. And the current theory is based on real studies of how fast tissue really breaks down, and then extrapolating backwards shows that most tissue could only last at the most 100,000 years. Now, nobody's ever observed it, but this is based on real studies, and for the sake of time, I cut them out, but I referenced four studies that came up with that number. In addition to those things, she found more blood vessels with more blood cells in them, and Discoverer in 2006 reported on her finding. Schweitzer, her name is Mary Schweitzer, Schweitzer's dangerous discovery. This study, this shy paleontologist found soft, fresh-looking tissue inside a T-Rex femur. She erased the line between past and present, then all heck broke loose. That's true. You find that, you're kind of erasing a big line between past and present. And heck isn't breaking loose amongst me. I'm not shocked at that finding. In fact, I'm kind of embarrassed that we didn't look for it earlier. It's breaking loose amongst people who hold to a very, very, very old age of the universe and the Earth. And this is what the paper said. Translucent blood vessels, by all rules of paleontology, should have long since drained from the bones. It's a matter of faith among scientists that soft tissue can survive at most for a few tens of thousands of years, not the 65 million years since T. rex walked the Hell Creek Formation in Montana, which isn't really that far north of Gillette here. It's almost straight north, a little bit northeast of here. Do you know where Glendive, Montana is? It's up there by Glendive on that. It's nice to go to a part of the country where people are not geographically illiterate on there. I go to some places down south, like a big state down there, and they can't hardly find Dallas. I mean, it's nice on there. So, how long can tissue really last? Just let me give you an example. This is the Norwegian seed vault. Now, Norwegians are really interesting because they think the world is going to be destroyed in a nuclear holocaust. So they've taken one of their frozen islands, of which they have several to choose from, and they've dug a tunnel into the island. And they're storing seeds in there, all different kinds of seeds, so that any survivors of the holocaust can go and get the seeds and what? Recultivate the world. And this is an interesting vault. There's big vault doors, and the seeds are stored behind them, but the seeds are in sealed aluminum containers, inside sealed cans, kept at the same temperature without light beating on them, same humidity, all of that, behind two vault doors and protected by a polar bear. I mean, that's really, really safe on there. And this is what they say. The seed vault is the perfect place for keeping seeds safe for centuries, says Kerry Fowler. At these temperatures, seeds and important crops like wheat, barley, and peas, I notice they didn't say, something like lima beans, anyway, can last for up to 10,000 years. Well, that may be. Why didn't she say 10 million years? Why, under these perfect conditions, aren't they going to last for that? Because seeds, even kept in perfect conditions, are naturally breaking down. So even under great conditions, you're not getting out to millions of years. So now you want me to believe that an animal that was buried, laying in the dirt, out in the open, kept its tissue around for 65 million years? And there's other things they found. Other tissues, in fact, this one right here is really interesting. These are actual cells. These are bone-forming cells called osteocytes, real cells. And additional research is found off of the horn of a triceratops up there. They get down below the bony tissue. It's actually cutaneous tissue. And the tissue is still stretching, not as cells, but entire sheets. Sheets of tissue are stretching. Well, it's not just dinosaur bone. Here was a paper reported on in 2000 where they isolated a supposedly 250 million-year-old bacterium that was found in a salt crystal, and it was still alive. Still alive, deep inside a salt crystal, supposedly 250 million years old. They were able to isolate it, put it on a dish, and grow it. Now that's one tough bacterium. 250 million years. This is another paper where they found the remains of the skeleton of things like crabs, horseshoe crabs, scorpions. It's made out of a substance called chitin. And the chitin is made out of proteins and sugars. Proteins and sugars. And these were found in an area from the Paleozoic era, which was supposedly 310 to 417 million years ago. Proteins and sugars lasting hundreds of millions of years now? Well, how do you explain it? Mary Schweitzer wrote an article in Scientific American called Blood from Stone in 2010, where she was going to explain how all this could happen. And she showed several pictures of other types of soft tissue that were found in addition to hers. And she said this: "But many in the scientific community remained unconvinced. Our findings challenged everything scientists thought they knew about the breakdown of cells and molecules." And it did. So I read through the paper, wanting to find the explanation. Got all the way to the last paragraph of the last page, and it says this: "Our work does not stop here. There's still so much about ancient soft tissues that we do not understand. Why are these materials preserved when all our models say they should have been degraded? And the paper ends. That's it. Still no answer, but the paper was supposed to tell me the answer. And as of today, there is no answer published anywhere in the scientific literature that can tell you how they can last for tens of millions of years and others can last for hundreds of millions of years. None. It's not out there. That is really an enigma. If you are open to other explanations, one explanation might be, maybe they're not tens of millions of years old. Maybe they're not. But that explanation isn't even allowed on the table. It's not even allowed out there. So you hunt for something else. But I'd say the most reasonable, simplest, natural explanation is they're not that old. They're not that old. So, assumed ages trumps real experimental evidence. Which then brings us to the whole idea that maybe experimental evidence actually shows that you're not going to get soft tissue lasting for more than 100,000 years. And in fact, I would argue there are far, far less. That is a real observation based on real things. So maybe they were buried in a worldwide catastrophic flood. Now let's move to the next one, carbon-14. How many of you heard of carbon-14? How many of you understand it? There we go, my head of the curve ninth grader in the back. There you go. Is that your bro too, to your right? Is he a pretty good guy? He looks at her. You better say yes. All right. All right. Carbon 14. This is based on some findings by one of my colleagues, Dr. Baumgartner, who published in 2005. What would you do if I told you that this pot of water had been boiling on the stove for 1,000 years? You know, you would say, no way, it's not boiling for 1,000 years, even if we could live 1,000 years. Well, you would try to prove me wrong, and you could measure how much water that pot could hold, right? You could measure, if you had a good instrument, how fast it's evaporating. And then you could extrapolate how long it could possibly be boiling. How long would it normally take to boil away a pot of water like that? A couple hours on that. That's how carbon-14 works, just like it. You start out with an amount, you know how fast it's leaving, and therefore you can estimate how long it's been around. Well, how does it start? It starts up in the atmosphere where nitrogen molecules, which make up the vast majority of our atmosphere, 78%, are hit by super high energy cosmic rays coming in from outer space. They hit it so hard that they change it from nitrogen completely to a different element called carbon. But it's not the typical carbon that's around, it's a radioactive type of carbon. But it's still in the atmosphere. And plants take carbon dioxide from the air, coupled with water, run it through a fancy schmancy process called what? Photosynthesis, and they make, do you remember what they make? They make glucose. They make sugars. Good. Right on top. They make sugars. Who likes to eat the sugars? Everybody. Creatures. You do. I do. They eat it. Well, some of that radioactive carbon is incorporated into those sugars along with the normal carbon. Make sense? The plants eat it. Plants make it. Animals eat it. We eat it, sometimes we eat the other animals, and when we do, you bring that radioactive carbon into your body. So you all are a little radioactive right now because you've been eating that stuff and you have some of this radioactive carbon. Well, eventually they die, and when you die, the bad news is you stop eating. So, you know, you stop eating and you no longer bring in that radioactive carbon. And you know what radioactive things do? They break down, and they start to break down to normal carbon at a rate, and we can measure the normal carbon compared to the radioactive carbon in the dead thing, and we can guess how long it's been dead. And that's how carbon-14 works. Make sense? Well, carbon-14 has a very, very, very short, what's called a half-life, about 5,700 years. That means after 5,700 years, half the original amount is gone. And in another 5,700, what? Half of that is gone. Half of that is gone. And after you do this about 10 times, there should be no measurable radioactive carbon left. And that takes between 50 to 100,000 years for that to happen. So anything that's definitely over 100,000 years, how much of that should be found in them? None. None. The problem is that every piece of ancient carbon tested has it. Not some, all of them. All of them have it. And it's not just a little bit that may be formed in the earth. It's at levels thousands of times higher by what can be formed endogenously in the earth. Really, really high. It's called the percent modern carbon. And it's supposedly in things that are tens or hundreds of millions of years old. Now, here's an experiment that our institution did. We ordered from the U.S. Department of Energy's Coal Sample Bank, which is maintained at Penn State University, three samples of coal that were supposedly 58 to 34 million years old. We asked for three samples that were 145 or older, and four samples that were very, very old, 280 to 320 million years old. We did not work these samples. We got these samples from the government, and samples were sent blindly to radiocarbon dating facilities. Multiple samples to multiple facilities. And we got back results. And this is what's interesting about the results. You don't have to understand what this number means, but they came back 0.26% modern carbon. That's normal carbon. And then the ones that were a little bit older, 0.21, and the ones that were oldest were 0.27, averaging out to about 2.24. Two observations you can make from that. One, you found it, and you shouldn't have found it, any of it. But second, look at the numbers. Regardless of whether you understand them, the numbers are all very what? Similar. Similar. Now, they shouldn't have been. If anything, they should have started to decrease because they got older and older and older. But they're all similar. So you find that and you date it out, and they actually come out, all of them date out to about 50,000 years. We did the same thing with diamonds. Diamonds that were supposedly 2 billion years old, got diamonds from diamond mines across the world, sent them to multiple testing facilities blindly, and they also dated out to about less than 50,000 years. Now that's very, very interesting, because these findings definitely contradict the claims of things being 10 to hundreds of millions of years old, and all of them have intrinsic carbon. But not only that, they seem to indicate that they invalidate all of the radiocarbon-14 studies, and they seem to point to the fact that all of these pieces were buried in sedimentary rocks at about the same time. Same time. Even though you have some coal on top of the coal on top of the coal, it all seems to be buried at relatively the same time. Not in events that are separated by many, many years. Now, what could bury multiple layers of coal all about the same time but a global flood? That is a good explanation for that. Now, some people push back and say, wait a second here, how can you believe in a global flood? You know, basically, where's the water? Well, here's a paper that was published in 2010, and basically it says, ancient oceans once covered much of Mars. Now, that isn't what Mars looks like today. That's a drawing. That's an imaginary drawing of what they think Mars looked like at one time in the past. And the article not only mentions that ancient oceans once covered much of Mars, it even said, and this is a quote, that Mars was covered with water of a size of a flood of biblical proportions. On that, as a biblical proportion. So it was covered by this water. Well, when you look at Mars today, how much of that water do you find? You know, you don't really, there you go. That's Mars. right there. You know, you don't find any of that free water. But they believe that Mars was covered with a flood of biblical proportions. But when you turn to our planet and you look at it from space, you see what? Lots of water. In fact, you spin around the globe over on the Pacific Ocean, and you can get to portions of the globe, and you look down, and that's almost nothing but water. And they'll ask me the question, where's the water? Where's the water? And it's like, well, it's here. It's here on the planet on that. We, all of us, hold the fact that the continents have moved up and down, and there have been activities to build mountain ranges and things like that. But if you smooth the planet out, you can cover the Earth in several miles of water, because you have lots and lots of water. And in fact, there's been drilling recently that in several parts of the world, subterraneanly, they estimate there's 3 times the amount of water underground as there is filling the entire oceans. So there's a lot of water, on this planet right here, depending on when you look. So, you know, you look at this right here, could a worldwide flood have covered the world? And if it did, what in the world would that look like? What would you seem to find for evidence? Well, fortunately, there was an experiment that happened in 1980 when this mountain in Washington, Mount St. Helens, blew its top. Now, that's obviously a pre-eruption picture. Very, very, very pretty. You know, by the way, you don't see a picture like that in Texas. No, you know, that's what it looks like. And then geologists knew that this was going to blow because the mountain was growing by 6 feet a day. So they knew activity was happening. And sure enough, there was a bunch of geologists, and they caught this fantastic picture in an airplane right when it blew. A massive eruption. It was primarily a huge steam explosion, a massive steam explosion. And then geologists on the ground captured these photographs. These are fantastic. And then it was rolling along the ground over 100 miles an hour, hundreds of degrees, wiping and devastating everything in its path, burying it. You probably have seen some of these photos before. And that's what it looks like now. It blew almost 3,000 feet of mountain off. Now, people who live in a mining area can appreciate that. You can. How much does it take to remove that much material? It was equivalent to over 40,000 Hiroshima-type bombs. You know, you're not just drilling a few holes and packing them with ANFO. It's a massive blow. And you leave a place of just utter, total devastation that now does look like Texas. I mean, that's what it looks like, just outside of Dallas. But anyway, on there. Well, the good news is, everybody wonders, do you really say that in Texas and walk out alive? Anyway, they left these layers of rocks. Here's this gal for scale. Now, first thing, gut reaction from what you've been taught in school, when you look at that picture, does it look old or look young? Old. You look at it, looks old. Now, when you see things, just so you know, it's because you've programmed your brain based on experiences, and your brain accesses memories so that when you see somebody who's older, you see somebody who looks old. And you've been programmed to think that this is really old. But the reality is all three of those layers were placed in basically 3 days, actually 2.5 days. And in this particular case, there's no debate because there were eyewitnesses. This entire sequence of layers, 1 day. This entire sequence, less than 1 day. And this sequence, 1 day. In two major events, 1980 with two events in that, and one event in 1982. Now, that should cause a little bit of reprogramming of what your brain says. When I see this, I see old. And seeing things is half the battle, because we've been taught to see them. And so when I see layers like this, as a mining engineer, a student at the School of Mines over here, I was taught that this looks really, really old, because all of these layers were basically like annual events, or maybe not even annual events. Do you know where you can go in Wyoming and find layers that look just like this? Lots and lots of places. But there's a really cool road cut between Rollins and Point of Rocks on I-80 that looks almost exactly like this. And it's got some folds in it, which I will point out there. Because I was taught in school, when you get an event that does this kind of layer, which looks very, very different than this kind of layer, which obviously looks different than all of these layers, that these had to be annual events. But every one of these layers was placed in one event in 4 hours. One event in 4 hours. And not just those layers here, even finer layers like this, and even super fine layers like that. Now that challenges a lot of thinking, because when I was a student at Tech, I was taught to get those really, really fine layers, you had to have very, very calm water, and the sediment settled out very, very slowly, very, very calmly, making super fine layers. That kind of made sense. That's kind of like how you would get them. I wasn't taught that you could get those in a very turbulent, dynamic situation, such as an eruption. But they can happen. They happen a lot. So when you look at that, it looks old, but it's really not old. It really wasn't old putting this down. Now look at those. Are those layers old or young? Programmed. They look old. In fact, if you went out to the Badlands of South Dakota, you would see a sign that says these are almost 66 million years old. But you can't tell now, can you, just by looking? Because they look like those layers at Mount St. Helens. In fact, if I didn't tell you they were from the Badlands, you might have thought those are Mount St. Helens. Okay, what about these layers? Are these old or young? I mean, look at that. You have a layer right here, and you have this hard rock right on top of that layer. Old or young? Well, these are young because these were placed in 3 days at Mount St. Helens. But you can't tell anymore just by looking. You actually have to have some history. But these are young layers. So what do we observe when we go to Mount St. Helens? We observe some very flat and extensive layers with a knife edge contact, just like the top layer of a cake, with no soil between the layers. Do you know what I mean by soil? Branches, leaves, dirt, vegetation that falls on it, decays and turns into soil. It takes several years to do that. But there's no soil between these layers. Maybe there were not several years between the layers coming down. Variety of composition, and when the layers are bent, they all seem to be bent together without cracking any of the layers. So they're all bent around. Now this is when you go to Grand Canyon. This is Dr. Andrew Snelling out of Grand Canyon, and you see the exact same layers with knife edge contact, all these layers right on top of them, with no evidence of any time gaps between the layers. This is from a road cut in Pennsylvania. And what do you see trapped right in that layer? Coal. You see a coal seam, boom, right down. Obviously, compared to Wyoming scenes, that's what? Teeny weeny. But nevertheless, it's there, and it's trapped totally flat with no life, you know, with no time between them. So what's probably happening is vegetation's being ripped off on the earth during the flood. It's floating around. You're getting things depositing. Some of that vegetation gets buried and gets immediately covered, trapping it, smashing it, flattening it down, just like that right there. This is back in Grand Canyon. You see those layers, and here is a really definite boundary that you find in Grand Canyon between the Hermit Shale on the bottom, which was supposedly placed in a watery environment, and the Coconino Sandstone, which is right on top of it, supposedly placed in a desert environment. And here's the line right between them. And that line supposedly represents a gap of 12 million years. 12 million. Now, wouldn't you expect to find a little bit of erosion happening over 12 million years? You know, a little uneven surface? But it's totally flat. And supposedly, the entire continent of North America was underwater when the dark pink layer was placed. And then the entire continent was raised out of water when the light sandstone was placed in a desert. So the entire continent is moving up and down on that. Could there be another explanation for putting those things down? Yes. There's evidence of soft sediments being rapidly deposited. So here's a layer in Grand Canyon that's been tipped up on edge, and the top layer is broken off and eroded away. And when you look at this layer of rocks, what are those? Winds or water. Those are ripples. That's right. They're ripple marks that you would find on the edge of a lake. Now, how long do ripple marks stay around before they get eroded away, before they wash away? Hours. Not days, and definitely not millions of years. But somehow these ripple marks were placed in this layer. Now you can imagine. Here's the flood. It's eroding things away, depositing massive sediments in other areas. It's intruding in. You get ripple marks. There's still tides. The water's still dynamic, but it's steadily what? Rising, steadily coming up. It's not just whoosh, you're flooded. It's coming in, depositing, retreating, steadily coming up. So it deposits this, makes the ripple marks, and comes in with another layer of sediment, and whoosh, covers them right up and buries them. Not only do you find ripple marks, but you find all kinds of animal tracks. I put a dinosaur track there because everybody likes dinos. But you can find dinos. You can find mammal tracks. You can find insect tracks. You can find raindrops between the layers. All kinds of delicate things which indicate the layers are put on top of each other very, very quickly. Very quickly. So this is good evidence of rapid deposition. You find billions of creatures rapidly buried. And they didn't decay and rot away, just rapidly buried and completely covered in those sediments. You find evidence of mass kills, dinosaur bones. You find evidence of very rapid burial. I mean, that's quick. That's quick. And you know, that was found out in just north of Green River in Wyoming. You're familiar with a town called Kemmerer? Kemmerer. You find these kinds of fossils out there. That's really quick. Here's an ichthyosaur that was in the process of giving birth. Rapidly buried with a little baby ichthyosaur right there. Man, gals, think about that. What kind of a Kodak moment is that? You know, to be caught in for all eternity, you know, right there on that. Rapid burial. And look at the sad face. I mean, oh man, that's something else. You find all kinds of mixed environments. Look at that, fish, palm trees. Here's a fish and a bird flattened together right there. All of this is giving evidence that this is not a slow, tranquil process, but this is a massive, devastating cataclysm. And it is wiping things out, and it's destroying them. Everything that had the breath of life was wiped out. And then throughout the flood, but particularly towards the end of the flood, you get a lot of tectonic activity. Tectonic means you get plates on the earth are moving. Mountain ranges are being built. Places in the Himalayas, the Rocky Mountains, all of that is being pushed up. And at this about the same time, the Black Hills are being pushed up. The Bighorn Mountains are being pushed up. The Rocky Mountains are being pushed up. You find other activity like Devil's Tower. Boom. All of this is happening towards the end of the flood. these things are coming towards the end. It's going to push these ranges up, and then floodwaters are going to come across and scour off and erode some of the materials on top of them. On top of them. So that's what's happening here. And it's bending rocks. It's bending materials massively. These rocks, when here's a person for scale, it's completely bending all of these rocks, but they're not cracked. They're not broken up. Rock is really, really, really brittle. So how do you bend solid rock without cracking it? Well, I was taught when I was a student at Tech that under incredible pressures, being deep, deep, deep in the earth, and high temperatures, that the rock would flow like toothpaste. That's what I was taught, and I remember writing it down in my little field book, rock flows like toothpaste. But I didn't know to ask the question, would those rocks have been metamorphosed? Do you know what it means by metamorphosed? They're changed from one type of rock to another type of rock at those very high temperatures. Would those rocks have been baked so that they were a different type of rock? And the answer is yes. In order to get rock to flow like toothpaste, you bake it and you actually change it to another type of rock. But these rocks aren't changed. They're not metamorphosed. So maybe another explanation is that those sediments were still very, very soft when they were deposited, and then the ground moves and bends them, and they're not breaking because they're what? They really are soft and flexible. And you can, if you go out towards the Black Hills, you'll see massive layers just bent and arching up between spearfish and sturgis. You look on the towards the side of the road towards the Black Hills, you'll see massive layers that have been eroded, and you can see them, and they just bend and arch right up. Also in the Black Hills, you'll find all kinds of dinosaur tracks and other things like that. These strata were bent without cracking. So did we get all of these layers stacked right on top of each other, as one layer gradually building up over time? Or could they have all been put down very, very rapidly in one event, a year-long worldwide flood? I think that argues for it. And then in the last few minutes here, we'll just cover some erosion, some erosive events. In 1982, a massive mudslide came through and eroded some huge canyons out there at Mount St. Helens. Now, look at that picture. Does it look old or look young? It looks old. It looks really old. And you see this little creek running through here? You could think this creek maybe eroded this canyon. But it didn't. The canyon was eroded and made a place for the creek. That's what the sequence of events really was. And look, the canyon is 1/40th the scale of Grand Canyon. And the sediments are standing almost straight up after it was cut through by this little creek here. Now, when you look at that, I have to admit, that looks old, but it doesn't look old in my mind anymore. It doesn't. The only thing that really looks dated in this picture is this guy's clothes. I mean, it's like, wow, something like that. Well, here's a canyon in Texas. They had a lot of rain down there, and in one day, the dam spilled over and cut this canyon through solid rock in one day. And now the Texans have turned it into a tourist attraction and charge admission to see it. But anyway, cut through solid rock in one day. Okay, is this canyon old or young? See, now you don't know. I've changed your thinking. You just go out there and you say, I don't know. Well, this canyon is that one in Texas that was cut in one day. One day, through those solid rocks. Ah, old or young? Well, this is one in Grand Canyon that supposedly took 5 million years to cut. But you can't tell. But you know, when I look at that, it looks like it was swept through very, very quickly with something that just went sweeping through that baby. On that. Okay, Mount St. Helens had a lava dome that has since grown. We were able to sample materials from the lava dome. And how old was the lava dome? Well, it was 29 years old when it was sampled, and it was set off for radiometric dating, and it came back at 2,400,000 years old by conventional radiometric dating. And it's not just the lava dome in Mount St. Helens. I actually had 5 pages of these slides showing real observed eruptive events where the exact ages were known, and they were sent off for radiometric dating, and they came back with that many millions of years. Maybe there's something a little unreliable about this radioactive dating. So what do we observe when we go out to places like Grand Canyon? Or if you go, I'm actually glad I can talk with people who know these things. If you go down south of Green River, Wyoming, you will find canyons that are not quite as big, but they look very, very much like that. They'll be down to the southeast of Green River. You'll find these huge canyons. You can see some of them from I-80 looking south over there. And they're made out of the same rocks. You find the exact same things that you find in Mount St. Helens. And here's something that I never knew I wasn't seeing until somebody pulled it off, pointed it out to me. This is Grand Canyon. And look at these rocks. These have supposedly been eroding for 5 million years, at least 5 million years to make this canyon. What aren't you seeing here? Well, for the sake of time, I'll tell you. These rocks would be breaking off and rolling down these slopes. Breaking off and rolling down, breaking off and rolling down. Where's all the rock debris? Why isn't it laying on those slopes? If it's been eroding for 5 million years, it's because it hasn't been eroding. That was cut through by waters running off this continent or maybe a breached lake, and it carved that baby quickly, and it took that debris with it. Now, I'm encouraging you and I'm challenging you. As you drive around this country and you drive down into the southwest, here it is. Here's some of that rock debris laying on the slopes. But these have supposedly been eroding for tens of millions of years. Where's the debris? What I see piled up there is equivalent of several thousands of years of erosion. Please keep that in mind as you look around. You're not going to see evidence of long, long period of erosion. And look at the thickness of these layers in Grand Canyon, all deposited by water. Here's a great question to ask your teachers in school. If the present is the key to the past, what processes today are making super thick sedimentary layers? That's a really good question. I wish I would have asked my geology professors. And not only are they making them super thick, those are layers in Grand Canyon, and you can see those exact same layers up here in the Black Hills. In fact, when you go to Bear Country, you know where Bear Country is out there, you'll drive through the exact same layers that are in Grand Canyon. And then you can pick those layers up in Canada, trace them over into Greenland, pick them up in Europe, trace them into Asia, find them in Africa, and probably they're in Australia. You find these same layers covering the entire continents in the entire world in the same sequence. So what processes today are putting down layers that are super thick that cover entire continents? Right on top of each other. Boom, 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 boom. Probably a worldwide flood. And then finally, I know we have some big, big, deep coal deposits, but there's some coal deposits in the country which are so extensive, they cover entire states. Entire states. What processes today do we see, if the present is the key to the past, which are burying vegetation that is so thick that it's so extensive it covers entire states? Maybe a worldwide flood put those deposits, all that vegetation down. Ripped it up from the earth, floated it on the waters, and buried it. And right here, what we find the Powder River, what? The Powder River Basin. That's because you have the Bighorn Mountains being pushed up, you have the Black Hills being pushed up. It took those layers from the flood, bent them right up in that basin, vegetative material beached thick enough to get layers out by the Wyodak that's 80 to 100 feet thick. And then some additional layers came on top of it and buried it right in there. And that's a great explanation for something like the Powder River Basin coal on that. Well, I think there's some pretty good evidence, as you're looking around, for a worldwide flood, and no reason to doubt when the Bible says, in 6 days God created the heavens and the earth and all that is therein, that we can take that normally. Thank you so much, and we'll pick up at church. Pastor.